WHQR Public Media in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Deborah Dix Maxwell was born in Wilmington, North Carolina, and calls it home, but she's lived and traveled around the world. Despite her boarding school days in South Carolina, college in Pittsburgh, graduate school at East Carolina, military tours of duty, which include Korea and Operation Desert Storm, Deborah Dix Maxwell is familiar to many local residents from her advocacy work. She is the president of the new Hanover County chapter of the NAACP, which celebrates its 102nd year this May. And while we will explore her work with the NAACP today, we're going to meet her in a slightly different capacity, the unofficial one, as the human she is through the life she has led. Deborah Dix Maxwell, what a pleasure to welcome you to Coastline.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
You know, part of the idea for talking to you this way about your personal life and the life that you've lived came from a recent Cape Fear Museum-sponsored talk about the racial divide. And you were a guest on the panel, and the host introduced you, including a reference to your military experience, which is something I hadn't heard about before. Not that I'd heard everything about you, and talked about you being a veteran of Operation Desert Storm. Would you tell us about that time in your life?
Definitely. I was in my last semester of graduate school. I'd been in the reserves, had already gotten out the Army, was in the reserves. And on the day after my daughter's birthday, I got deployed for Saudi Arabia because I held a medical MOS, which is military occupational specialty. So they took a number of us over there because I was an OR tech at that time. And we combined and made a unit. And it was an experience that one will never forget. If I ever meet a guy who popped those scuds out the sky, I'm going to give him a big hug. And I say a guy because at that time, women, I do not believe were allowed in combat flight like that.
What was it like, especially for those who aren't familiar with Operation Desert Storm? And of course, that was authorized by President at the time, George Bush. And this was to expel the Iraqi occupation, Iraqi soldiers from Kuwait. You said you were an operating room technician. You were working with a medical unit, but it still was very scary for you.
Oh, definitely. We would have alerts, and you have different levels. It's called MOP 1, 2, 3, and 4. And 4 is fully geared for chemical attack. And I remember one night before we went out into the desert, someone tapped me on my shoulder. I was sleeping and said, "We're at MOP 4. But the problem was she was already in MOP 4. So I held my breath as I put on my mask, my boots, my protective gear. And those in the military who were former military will laugh about that, because that meant if it was had truly been MOP 4, I would have been dead. She waited till she put on her stuff before she told me to put mine on.
You've also said that from that time, water means so much more to you. Water is sacred. Talk about that.
Water is precious. Being in a medical unit, our doctors decided to steal the water for everybody. Unfortunately for them, we found out who had the water. No one was hurt, but we got the water back. Water is precious. When you're sitting in 100-plus degree heat on a daily basis, there's no air around, it's precious. You got to wait on a bladder to come in for the showers. You're using field latrines that are set up like stalls. Water is so important. So I'm very much a stickler about that. You know, if I don't use everything, I save it to water the plants or do something else. But people have to understand it is the basis of our life, a very important basis of our life.
So you were part of these recent conversations that the Cape Fear Museum sponsored on the history of the racial divide here in Wilmington, the idea of racial reconciliation. What What have these conversations done, if anything, to move the whole issue forward?
There have been a number of conversations within this community. Most important, we have to bring about awareness also so that the conversation can have a positive impact. The city has started, I can't remember the name of the group that they have. There's also just last week started a poverty task force, which is embedded in a lot of racism, because you don't get out of poverty if you're offered the educational opportunities to take yourself out of it. So I see progress. I wish there was more at a greater pace, but then you have things like the racial integrity bill that just came up. I mean, it's voter integrity, but it's really racial. I said it right the first time.
Yeah,
we have a long way to go.
You're talking about the bill that would change North Carolina elections law. I think it's not as sweeping as the one that was recently enacted in Georgia.
I think this
particular bill, according to WFAE, some of the biggest changes would be the deadline as to when people could request an absentee ballot and a deadline as to when they would need to have it back. And they would need to have it back, I think, by 5 p.m. on Election Day, and they would need to request it 2 weeks before Election Day. Help us understand why that concerns you, if that were to get passed.
It concerns me because people need time. Our postal system is still not where it should be. I have veterans who haven't been getting their medication on time, and probably others who use prescription mail. So we need that fail-safe for that. And I think that Senators Hiss, Danion, and Newton did that because they didn't want to be left behind, because all the other states were already doing it. There were already 40 different states that had put in some sort of suppression laws. And I thought we were safe for a minute in North Carolina. And then they popped this up. But God doesn't like ugly, because Senator Hiss sitting home with COVID right now.
Now, you have a theory on why there is this movement towards what you call these voter suppression bills. What is your theory on that? Why are these things coming up so much now in state legislatures across the country?
Well, some people think that the election was stolen, which it was not. And they have the audacity to believe that I can't believe all those black people came out and voted and put Joe Biden in the White House. So now we're going to counter and make things harder for them to come back the next time. But we just exercise our basic right in a large manner. We voted. And obviously we are not enough of a population to change the vote. So definitely we had allies who didn't look like us who also voted.
You've also said that the previous administration gave permission to white supremacists and other folks to express their hate overtly rather than covertly. Are you talking about on a national level, or are there things that happened locally that surprised you? Because you have said that you learned things about people who were more comfortable being overt. Did it happen locally for you?
It has happened locally, and I should say regionally, because remember last year we had the three policemen on the first time Chief Williams was hired. That shows you that that was something that shouldn't have been allowed. Instead of protecting the public, and they're denigrating the public. I found out that in Columbus County, which is only an hour away from here, that is one of the largest groups of oath keepers in the state.
And the oath keepers are a white supremacist organization.
Yes, they are. And they deny that they are in Columbus, but there are too many of them. It's been alleged the sheriff is a member also.
And so this is something, I mean, these are issues that you have worked on your almost entire adult life as you've worked on other issues as well. You went to graduate school and received your Master of Social Work. What was it about social work that drew you, and why did you decide to go that route?
I went that route because my undergrad was business, and I wasn't too happy doing the business-like thing, so I kept volunteering all the time. So my sister said, you might as well get an MSW. But I wasn't sure until the final end, because preparing for graduate school, I took the GRE and the GMAT because I wasn't sure if I was going to a joint program or just a social work degree. There are some MBA MSW programs, not that many.
Yeah. And then when did you actually move back to Wilmington?
86. And I went to graduate school in 89. Yeah.
And at this point, you had gotten married and you had a daughter. Is that right? Or do I have the chronology wrong there?
My daughter came before graduate school. She would love to hear that, though.
Okay. Well, we're going to hear about this when we come back from this break. You're listening to Coastline. We're talking with Deborah Dix Maxwell, who is the current president of New Hanover County's NAACP. When we come back from this short break, we're also going to find out why she got involved with the NAACP much later than she had initially hoped. We'll be back from this short break in 90 seconds. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. If you've been in Wilmington for any length of time and pay attention to local issues, Deborah Dix Maxwell is a name you will know. She is the current president of the New Hanover County NAACP, but that is just her current title. And today we're learning more about what led her back to Wilmington and why she settled on social work and advocacy for people who are marginalized as her life's work. But before we went to break, Deborah Dix Maxwell, you were so gracious and did not want to call me out on a mistake that I made about the chronology in your life. But you actually, help us understand, you got your undergraduate degree in Pittsburgh. And then what happened? Because at some point in there, you joined the military, you got married, and you had a daughter, and then there was graduate school. So how did that go?
When I went to Pittsburgh, we're going to have to backtrack. I'd already gotten out of the Army and had a six-month-old. And I went to school there because my sister was working on her doctorate, and that left me a safe place to continue and get my degree at that time. And I joined the reserves, and unfortunately my unit switched and I would have to drive all the way down to Maryland when I moved that way on a red eye express down the turnpike, but I would make it. After that, I moved to the DMV, which I called, that's what everybody calls it now. Back then we called it DC or whatever, Chocolate City and stuff. Got a job in retail, but I was told my parents needed me at home. They weren't ill, but they were at that point where they needed someone, around for support. So I moved back to Wilmington and got here and could not find the jobs that I wanted because there was discrimination. They only hired one black at each bank back then. I couldn't even get a job as a teller. Oh, yes, they did. People ask me illegal work questions. There's certain questions you shouldn't ask people for employment purposes. And what these were people's.
What were some of those illegal questions that they asked?
I had
you?
A child, and the woman asked me how was I going to take care of child care with my daughter, because the job started at this position at 6:30. But I'm living with my parents, so at 6:30 when I get up, she's in the bed and they're in their room. Another one told me, well, you know, you kind of overqualified for this job. That was the one at the bank that wouldn't hire me. And I thought, I know that. I'm trying to get my foot in this door, which did not work. So I went into retail management again, which was what I was doing in Maryland. And I kept volunteering. I was at domestic violence stuff at church and stuff. And my sister said, you might as well just go back and get an MSW because you talk about what you're doing after work more than work. So I went back, and that's how I wound up getting my MSW from East Carolina.
And at this point, your husband is no longer a part of your life?
We had separated before I went back and finished my degree, but he had promised to take care of the divorce, and he didn't. He just put a deposit on it for some reason. So lo and behold, I cried one night to the man of my life, my father, and he said, get a checkbook. How much do you need to get divorced?
So your father paid for your divorce.
I'm sure I'm not the
divorce.
Only woman who's told has that story across this country. So he took care, because I was in school, you know, I didn't have a lot.
Yeah. And speaking of school, we haven't talked about boarding school in South Carolina. Your parents had moved to Wilmington, and your dad was a longshoreman, and your mom worked in a factory. They sent you to boarding school in South Carolina, and this was a Catholic school, even though you were raised as a Methodist. So to help us understand why they chose that for you.
They chose that for me because my siblings went to Williston, and they could afford to send me to parochial school, and they did. Some people thought that meant I was stuck up. No, I'm thankful and grateful for the opportunities that they afforded me, because I could not do it. And at that time, I would have gone to DC Virgo, and some girls weren't nice to Catholic school girls who were going to Virgo. That's all I'm going to say. You know, it's a long walk home safely. So my parents decided to send me on to Catholic school where they were from originally, which is Sumter, because they migrated here with the World War II migration, which a lot of blacks and whites moved to Wilmington from South Carolina.
Yeah, Wilmington was booming at that point. So
a lot.
What was Catholic school like for you? And was this a segregated school or an integrated school?
The boarding school was integrated. St. Thomas was not, which is now closed. And when they closed it, they moved us to St. Mary's, which is now the Basilica now. For me, it was normal because it was my life and my, you know, experience going to Mass 5 days a week, because you got there early because your parents dropped you off, or you got there early. Then you went to your own church on Sunday. So yeah, I used to go to church 6 days a week. Can you believe it? a nun. I was raised by nuns and my parents. So when I went to basic training in the military, there wasn't much drill sergeant could do to me, because I'd already been indoctrinated through the nuns. They have fear factor more than I'm seriously.
What were some of the scariest things that a nun could threaten you with? How did they exact discipline?
Well, when you're a child, it's the fear. Now, some kids got their ears tugged. I never got my ear pulled a pinch, I have, you know. and then there were switches at the back. They're apartments now across from Community Arts Center. And it was just that you wanted to do good. Like my mother, most people think of black parents or Southern parents using physical punishment. I can't say that about my father, but my mother never touched any of us with a switch, a belt, or anything. But it was just a desire to please her by how she talked to you and make her feel good about what you did, that you didn't do any wrong, because you wanted your mother to be proud of you.
when you spoke with our producer, Rachel Keith, you talked about how schools in this area were forced to integrate, but you, and you weren't part of this because you were off in South Carolina at Catholic boarding school, but you mistakenly used the word segregate and then laughed and said, well, same thing. And it was a slip, but you weren't kidding. What did you mean by that?
I wasn't kidding because we're supposedly integrated to schools. But if you live in New Hanover County long enough, you know that some school board members purposely segregated our elementary schools by making them magnet schools in the inner city. And it still to this day is in effect. And so that was purposeful segregation, but yet it's supposed to be under the guise of integration. And when you question them about it, I remember I'd ask board member Higgins, and they, don't talk to me. You got to ask the realtors. We just made the neighborhood. We just made them because they're neighborhood schools. That would always be their escape clause for why they did what they did.
And so what is the answer to that? I mean, as long as neighborhoods are segregated, is it busing? Is it working on desegregating neighborhoods? What is the answer?
Neighborhoods should be desegregated if by choice, and people are desegregating neighborhoods, but you have charter schools, which are taking children out of public schools on the other side also. So one of my dreams is if I win the lottery, I'm going to hire a lot of those grandparents and someone's not working who have the capacity to care and put them as TAs/volunteers in Freeman, Snipes, and Gregory. So when our scores go up exponentially and those who are outside move up, they will want to come to our schools in town. And it's just a matter of scores, that's all.
It sounds a little bit like perhaps the golden age of Williston School. You had siblings go to Williston before forced integration in Wilmington when it was an all-Black school. And tell us about what Williston was like then, even though you didn't get a chance to go there. You were too young.
I cried. They closed the day I was going in ninth grade. That was the year before that. Williston was a proud school, still is to graduates. When you left there, you got an education. My brother went to Yale, and when he got there, he met guys from like Northfield, Mount Hermon, and Phillips Exeter. And they were shocked that he knew Canterbury Tales. I would help my sister study the preamble, the Raven, Hamlet's soliloquy. Those are the ones I remember. Remember, I'm like 8 or 9 years old, and she's in high school, and they're learning all these things that stuck with me till I went to school. So you got a full education. Sometimes now, it's not always the best. Especially now with COVID.
And I've heard some Williston graduates from that era say things like, we knew we were loved.
They did.
We knew that if we misbehaved or didn't live up to expectations, somebody in the neighborhood or the teacher was going to come to our house and talk to our parent. I mean, there was just such connectivity, it sounds like, and support.
There was. My sister had an issue with a class, and the teacher told my daddy, just bring her by. And he would drop her off there in the summer at no cost. And she taught her, I think it was a math thing. My brother's a math whiz, probably was. But she did it on her own time, out of her leisure. I remember she lived on South 8th Street. Because my sister would always visit her when she came home.
You're listening to Coastline. Today, my guest is Deborah Dix Maxwell. She's the current president of the New Hanover County chapter of the NAACP. And Deborah Dix Maxwell, one of the sort of unique elements of your dynamism here. And one of the reasons I think that you're a power broker in the Cape Fear region is partly because you know everybody. If you don't know them, then they're either new or they're not important. But can you talk about, yes, I said that, walking the line? Because we know that Wilmington has this uniquely fraught racial history, which is part of what the Cape Fear Museum's conversations were about, shining a light on, especially fraught, more than in other places in this country. But we've heard from people, including Bertha Todd, who said there's something of an 1898 mentality here. There is among some folks a mentality about, you know, just keeping your head down, not drawing attention to yourself. There's this balance that some people strike, walking the line between calling out white people for ignorant stuff, including well-meaning white people. And there's this, you know, the other side of that coin is calling it as you see it. You are elegant and gracious, but you also tell the truth. Can you talk about that and how you've thought about it, and if you've ever worried about alienating white power brokers?
Well, truth-telling started at an early age, and these big girls were going to try and hit me in boarding school because I told the truth about something about somebody's boyfriend. That's when I realized it struck a nerve, okay? It's just part of my makeup. I almost started to put on my Facebook page since my Instagram got hacked. If you don't want to hear the truth, bypass this page. I'm not going to sugarcoat it. And I came to the deliberation that a lot of people in the South try to be dainty and sweet and sugarcoat stuff instead of being direct. I know when my daughter was in school, I had an issue with a teacher, but the principal I had an issue with too, and neither one were direct. And I would put on my dashiki or something. My daughter said, "You're going to my school." So I didn't wear that to work. She could tell because I would wear that. So I think that there's been too much not being truthful. If I'm too in your face, I'm sorry. But we're in a lot of the problems we are now because people have not been factual. They haven't been upfront with what's going on. And so that's part of why some people don't like to communicate clearly or don't know how. And that's a major issue also. So I just want everyone to understand if I say it, I meant it. And if I'm wrong, I'll apologize. If I'm right, I'm standing 110% behind whatever I said.
What elements of the local racial reconciliation conversation are not yet fully honest at this point? I mean, I heard in the Cape Fear Museum's conversations, several people said things like, "We have to get honest. We have to get real with each other." How are we not yet being honest? What is missing?
Sometimes in the workplace, things are missing where people are trained, hired, and then they train the person to be over them, the African-American person. That's not fair or correct when you have years of experience and you train someone to take your place. Sometimes about how you look. I got on my pretty new silver hoops today because some whites think silk hoops are unprofessional, but yet black women do love to wear hoops. Someone was told that by their supervisor in a professional setting. Just look at housing. We're being gentrified but like crazy, and now all of a sudden someone wants to make an effort. But you knew this was happening all along. This is nothing new. People have to really be allies and help each other here and not try and see, what can I get over on black people this week? I'm about a house for nothing and make money off of it.
You said that it took you longer than you wanted it to get involved in the NAACP. Why is that? And it still sounds like you got involved early, but what was it about the NAACP that drew you and made you want to be part of that?
I think partially started when I was in Detroit. I had a friend who used to go to Benjamin Hook's church, and she used to talk about him. And then I started reading up on it, and then I moved away from there. And so then I tried to join, and I couldn't because no one would mail me an application. So I make sure that, yes, it happened more than once. So I make sure that my members have applications and have access.
And you, when you finally did get an application, you wound up joining the wrong chapter or something?
Because I did it electronically, and Ms. Dolores Moore told me, you got the wrong branch. She got me straight, though, later.
And so how long have you actually been a member of the NAACP?
That's a good question. Maybe 25 years.
And you knew at one point that you wanted to be part of its leadership.
It sort of snowballed, really. It just morphed.
Okay, we'll hear about that when we come back from this break. You're listening to Coastline. It's a conversation with Deborah Dix Maxwell, community pillar and advocate, as well as current president of the New Hanover County NAACP. We'll hear how she became president and why right after this short break. Stay with us. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline, I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Deborah Dix Maxwell comes from the generation that saw legal racial segregation followed by forced integration policies. She was born in Wilmington, North Carolina, went away to boarding school in South Carolina, then Pittsburgh for an undergraduate degree in business. Then she went to graduate school at ECU, where she earned her MSW. She eventually returned to Wilmington, where she has worked as an advocate for victims of domestic violence, children who could be considered at risk, and for racial reconciliation, among other issues. She is the current president of New Hanover County's NAACP, and she is with me now. Deborah Dix Maxwell, just before we went to break, we talked about your movement into leadership in the NAACP. How did that happen, and who kind of took you under their wing to show you the ropes?
For some reason, I gravitated towards Ms. Moore, who's Wayne Moore's mom, and she was the president. And unfortunately, our treasurer died in a car wreck. So my church member became the treasurer, and I became her assistant treasurer to help her during that tragedy. And then I moved on to treasurer because she didn't want to stay treasurer. She just pinch hit it. And then became first vice. And under Mr. Beatty, who was the then president, Harold Beatty, after we did it once or twice, he said, I'm not running again, and I'm going to teach you how to do this. And so there I went, going to all the different meetings with him and stuff. And the progression of offices were also good to assist me in that, because then I understood the basics more so than the average person in the branch.
And so when you think about the local NAACP's agenda for 2021, what would you like to see happen by the end of the year?
By the end of the year, I want to see the majority of people vaccinated, the historically marginalized populations, an increase in voter education / registration. And I say that because we have over 800 young African-Americans, 18 to 25, who did not vote the last election. There might be more, but I got ballot phone numbers for that many. So they need an education. I thank them for the registration, but we really needed them to be educated and know that we needed their vote.
You know, you were the first person to educate me about the 411 on the 50. And this was an actual brochure that you said, I don't know if you still give it out, but this was a few years ago. You don't, but you used to give that out as part of an educational campaign. And that was my first introduction as a white person to the idea that living through an encounter with law enforcement is a concern for people of color. And of course, this has since become a national conversation. You don't give this brochure out anymore. What has changed since then?
Brochure came from National, which has changed. And I need to see if they still have them. And they were a hot item wherever I went. I could never keep enough of those because people say, I got a group of young boys here. Or Ms. Glendora said, I need them to give out in Creekwood. I could never keep those. And I need to check back and see whether they have them. I know Legal Aid or ACLU makes one, but this one was really right on point with what to do and what not to do.
And it points to this larger issue, you know, Black parents talking to their children at some point about living through an encounter with law enforcement, but also talking about some of the broader issues. And white parents generally don't have to have conversations like that with their kids. Did your parents talk with you about what it meant to be Black in North Carolina in the 20th century?
They always stressed that we had to do better. We had to be better, to watch out when you went to work. My aunt would be the one who had those conversations. She just passed last month. She was the activist who educated us about things. I grew up watching Toni Brown's Black Journal with her and different things. So I got it both ways. And it was beneficial because, like I think I told Rachel, of all the oppression and suppression that Black people go through, you do not see Black people being eliminated from their job for saying something racially disparaging. But you see it happen to white people because they weren't taught at home not to be like that. They were taught a possible thought of superiority, which no one has. We're all human. So they feel free to show some caucasity and say a bad remark, and they're out of a job.
Do you remember talking with your daughter about those sorts of issues as she was growing up?
Some of that, and also being a parent, we teach workplace issues, just general comments on how to stay safe in the work environment. And you just have to. And it's not meant to be, it's just a survival thing that one has to do because at the end of the day, you want to see your child come home.
What's an example of a workplace survival protocol that you would need to teach your daughter?
You teach people about the warnings you can have in this state. This is a right to work state, so it's easy to lose your job. It's easier in this state to lose your job, unfortunately. And so people will start and say, oh, you didn't do this right, and I'm going to give you an oral warning. Okay. Oh my goodness, it looks like you did something else. So I'm gonna give you an all written warning. So that's two strikes in your paper file. You didn't do something else right, or you didn't do that right. And none of these you were counseled about previously. And so that third strike, you could be out in this state. I've seen people try it. It was tried on me when I worked. It didn't work. That's because I spoke back to him, though, defending myself and my team. So he didn't like that, so he tried to get rid of me. Didn't work. So every time he runs for office, I go out and make sure he has people who say, remember that man? you might not want to vote for him.
You, part of your military career involved being an MP.
Mm-hmm.
And considering that that is one of the issues as president of the NAACP that you've really had to work on locally, and I imagine are still working on, you're in this unique position because you understand through your own experience what law enforcement, regulation enforcement is about. Can you understand some of the law enforcement officers who feel unfairly targeted by this conversation about people of color wanting to live through, for example, a traffic stop? Can you help bridge that gap, I guess, between what it means to be law enforcement and why there's a whole concern for people of color in that world?
Unfortunately, today you've had an infiltration of supremacy and militia groups into law enforcement. They're there. And so it doubles the standard. You already in law enforcement sometimes are isolated because of you being law enforcement. MPs were kind of isolated from we were even isolated in Fort Lewis from the whole post. We were in the woods, not even on main post. So then you have that isolation of work, and then you're having to enforce with people who are not understanding that you're doing this. In fact, I only gave out a few tickets at Fort Lewis, but one of those tickets was in the levy section, which afforded me a free trip to Korea for 2 years. And my supervisor told me, he said, you don't ticket them because they'll get you back. And sure enough, I got paid back with orders to leave. So sometimes people can be retaliatory, and there's no need to be, but at the end of the day, we're all human. And we are working hard on the governor's racial equity task force to right the wrongs, to make standards where we will know when officers are not being correct in their behavior to citizens. I tell someone, if they aren't doing right, you can file a complaint. The WPD complaint is online. You can call me, but first you need to file a complaint. And sometimes it's ingrained behavior that needs to be eroded from the person who's been there 20, 30 years. And maybe it's time for them to just retire and go home with that attitude. We don't need it now. We're trying to be a more unified society, not a separated / segregated. As Martin Luther King said, we're all in the same boat. We definitely are.
You mentioned earlier acknowledging the fact that Wilmington now has its first Black police chief, and this is a person who actually grew up in Wilmington. And you also mentioned, we heard about, this conversation among some Wilmington police officers was recorded when they were engaging in, really shocking racial disparaging language. It was racially disparaging. It was shocking, and they were let go. But where do you think we are now? And do you see a change yet? Is it too early to talk about whether there's change, or are you hopeful?
There have been improvements made by Chief Williams. He has engaged the police department in a training. I think it's called ABLE. That is to improve relations. They've hired traffic investigators instead of policemen, because that's where a lot of things happen at traffic stops. I see an improvement, and you can ask someone else and they say he hadn't done a doggone thing, because there are always going to be critics when you're in positions of visibility and law enforcement. but he has made moves and strides. We attended a training as part of something he was doing last year, and I'm sorry, I can't remember the name of it, but it had to do with race. He could tell you what I can't remember. But it's unfortunate he's going to be the scapegoat for some people, and he's not going to be that for others.
In the last several years, especially the last year, we've seen this expanded global conversation about white supremacy and the damage that it's done and continues to perpetrate on people of color. Locally, New Hanover County has renamed a park that was named after a white supremacist, renamed it to Longleaf Park. Two statues in downtown Wilmington, George Davis and a Confederate soldier, were taken down by the city and put into storage. How do you think it's going here?
On the surface, it's going well. You forgot the Joseph McNeil Way, Memorial
yes.
Boulevard, too.
That's right.
And also, there's Arts Council is raising money for a Joseph McNeil statue. But you still have subversives in each group who don't want things to change. I like it the way it is. And we just have to, if we don't win them over, we're going to knock them over, because that means we will neutralize them, because they just have to be neutralized so we can move forward. I want my grandsons to enjoy living here when they come to visit Granny.
And you've observed that this is a tourist town for some people, but you've talked about reimagining Wilmington.
Yes.
And you compared it to Pittsburgh reimagining itself when the steel mills closed. What might be a new, a reimagined Wilmington?
It has to not be dependent on tourism, not dependent on over-exploiting our trees and land for the people who want to just move down here. And they don't realize we're losing all our trees. River Lights used to be the swamp. My church used to own property down there. And people telling me, oh, I live on a marsh. You know why the locals don't live on a marsh generally? Water moccasins and mosquitoes proliferate those places, and sometimes the alligator. So we have to learn to be better in Wilmington.
And you mentioned COVID vaccines. You're helping people find places to get the vaccine. We know that there are people who are skeptical about it, worried about it. What would you say to those folks who aren't convinced that it's a safe thing to do?
Your president took it. Your former president took it. If we don't take it, we're just going to recontaminate. And living in this tourist town, you don't know where people are coming from and what germs they're bringing to Wilmington. So you might as well vaccinate and protect yourself down here, especially with so many of us being in the tourist industry or hitting the beaches.
And very briefly, if you could just go back and talk to your younger self when you were struggling the most, what would you say to her?
It'll be all right. Especially when she was a young divorcee. I don't know how I made it to school some days. I cry across the bridge and wake up and be on the other side.
Well, that is this edition of Coastline. Deborah Dix Maxwell, what a pleasure to have you with us today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks also to Coastline producer Rachel Keith and technical director Ken Campbell. Andrew Craig engineered today's episode. Coastline is a production of WHQR Public Media. And if you missed part of this episode, look for it at whqr.org or find the podcast on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.